Hi there. Welcome to Mushroom Hour. Today on the Mushroom Hour podcast, we are honored to be joined by Kyle Garoni, the production manager at Far West Fungi, the beautiful mushroom farm down near Santa Cruz, California, a mushroom farm that has been quite critical to my personal mushroom journey. Kyle, thank you so much for joining us on the Mushroom Hour.
Thank you for having me, Darren.
Like I said, some of those community events you did in like 2016, 2017, where we went down, got to be in community with people that were into mushrooms. That was the first mushroom farm I had ever been to. Jumping on the piles of blocks and taking spent mushroom blocks and bringing them home. That was like what made me into the mushroom person I am today. Such an honor to finally get to speak with you and speak with the team. I am super curious because I've heard a little bit from your dad on some of the origins of Far West Fungi down at Hunter's Point. But tell us a little bit about your story, what it's like being part of this like scion family in mushrooms, what it's like growing up around a mushroom farm, and how you eventually got involved in Far West.
So yes, I grew up in a family mushroom business. I think now it's been like 42 years when my parents started the business, early 80s. So I've only been around mushrooms. My introduction was farmers markets. I've been doing farmers markets since I was 12 years old.
Wow. You've been selling mushrooms for 30 plus years.
Yes. So I've been around it. All things mushrooms, it's been awesome. You know, when I was a kid, you know, you would say, oh, my parents are mushroom farmers. Everyone would look at you a little strange and ask some interesting questions. Now with this whole mushroom, everyone's into mushrooms now. It's kind of weird because people are like, oh yeah, oh, so you guys go to Lion's Mane.
Right. They know all the gourmet mushrooms now.
No Lion's Mane, you know, like that was never a thing before.
Yeah, that's amazing. I mean, you guys have been, you know, doing this for so long that it's interesting probably to see this cresting of mushroom awareness and knowledge. I mean, the past 10 years, it's really accelerated. But I mean, in the 2000s, it just feels like there's this growing community and awareness and hopefully demand for mushrooms.
Definitely. Yeah. I mean, I think we have been pleasantly surprised at the willingness and openness of everyone looking and exploring all aspects of mushroom, from, you know, mushroom production to just cooking to using them in medicinal, you know, purposes. I think all of that has been quite amazing to me, at least.
And for you guys, is there kind of a conscious choice to integrate with mycology community? And what I mean is like citizen scientists, mushroom clubs. There are a lot of mushroom farms out there that, you know, they're doing their business. Maybe it's their family business, but they're really focused on growing the mushrooms, getting it to market. That's hard enough already. They're not like inviting weird mushroom people to come hang out at the farm. So how did that become like a choice you guys made? And what's that been like for you to kind of partner a little more intimately with mushroom foragers and community?
I mean, we've always been part of the San Francisco Mycological Society and the Santa Cruz Fungus Federation. So I think my parents wanted us to, you know, they've always enjoyed that and foraging and all aspects of just how mushrooms are involved in our lives. I think is something that is very important to us, you know, because we like the culture of mushrooms as well. I do a lot of consulting. I'll go to like Pennsylvania and it's very just farm focused. You feel like you're at a corn farm, but it's a mushroom farm, you know,
right?
It's like we're growing flesh, you know, something like that. And we're doing volume and we're moving this stuff out. And I think for me, it's always been slightly bizarre because I'm like, no, there's like this really cool thing we're doing. We're like growing mushrooms and like, this is really important for the community. And I don't think everyone has that same feeling. But again, as there's more and more mushroom farmers every day, and I think that's part of it too, is being part of that mushroom community is as important as growing the mushrooms.
And it speaks to the importance of the community that does promote all these other aspects of why we love mushrooms, why we love mycology. That disseminates to people who are in industries who work with more mushrooms than we can imagine day in, day out. And the fact that you're able to or the fact that the community is able to educate the farmers who then educate the community. I find that kind of in academic circles as well. There's the people who have studied mycology academically, but they've been studying that, and you can broaden that when they connect with other mycology community. And it's interesting, from like the farm and agricultural side, that can happen too. And there's this great cross-sporulation that happens that I really like in the mycology community.
Yeah, I mean, I learned a lot traveling the world. That's part of, I think, one of our strengths as farmers is that we don't, you know, we're looking outside of the United States. We're working with, we have partners like in Japan. I distribute machinery from Japan. So part of learning about mushroom farming is also seeing these cultures that are much more microphilic than the U.S. has been, you know, so learning their knowledge. It's very important to, I think, to somewhat understand what they're doing, integrate, see what works for us, and then allow us to kind of just launch ourselves, because there's no point in reinventing the wheel.
No, that's a massive perspective, actually. And we've talked about it on the show before, how there are these mycophilic cultures, whether it's in Eastern Europe or, yeah, especially Asia, when I think of like cultivation and medicinal use, it's such an embedded part of their culture for like centuries or millennia. But I think it takes, what do I want to say, a certain personality, a certain amount of humbleness and willingness to learn to be able to look at those cultures and say, whoa, you guys are doing this a whole other way, maybe a whole bigger way scale-wise, but to just put on that student hat and say, okay, I'm going to go over and learn from you now and bring it back. Because I know sometimes when I'm faced with situations like that, I tend to say, no, I need to stay focused on just my thing. But if you can kind of broaden yourself outside of your limited box sometimes, it really helps. And I'd love to hear that you guys are doing that.
Definitely. I think it's one of the most important things to realize that like there's these mushroom cultures and communities outside of the U.S. that are just so much, have a much longer history and appreciation of these fungi.
Yeah. And like I said, good on you for being willing to research and dive into that, take the best parts of that and try to bring it back and integrate it. Now, you know, you've referenced a couple pieces there about like the family already being really into mushrooms and foraging and all these different aspects, connecting with community. Now, we're broadcasting here at 103.3 KPCA in Petaluma up in Sonoma County. You're listening to the Mushroom Hour. We're speaking with Kyle Garoni of Far West Fungi, and you've seen their family's mushrooms in the grocery store. So give us the 10,000 foot view on what Far West has in terms of product offerings right now. Because obviously, like I said, we see it in the grocery store, but then you go down to the ferry building, there's kind of a whole other universe. And I'm like, whoa, they're trying so many different things out. So give us that overview of kind of the mix that Far West Fungi has.
So, you know, we grow fresh mushrooms, but we do a lot of mushroom products, mushroom jerky, extraction. We're starting to do a mushroom gummy line, truffle mustard, truffle oils, everything mushrooms, so anything you can think of. And then our new store has a whole cafe, so you can get your mushroom snacks, and we have lion's mane crab cakes. We have these like you can get the menu changes every like 3 or 4 months, and we have all different mushroom dishes, mushroom ceviche, which is like clamshell mushroom, oyster mushroom, all these different delicious dishes to kind of inspire people to say like, this is what these mushrooms can do for you.
And where is that location? I just referenced the ferry building. Is that there, or where's the location with the cafe?
Downtown Santa Cruz.
Downtown Santa Cruz. Okay. That's the one I have not been to yet.
Yes. Yeah. You should go. Next time you come, just let me know. We'll have a lovely lunch. We'll just order everything on the menu and we'll just drink our kombucha.
This sounds like my dream lunch scenario. But yeah, in terms of fresh mushrooms then, I know you're on the production side. What species are you guys cultivating? And talk a little bit about your production process. And if you can, we don't want to give away state secrets, but why you chose to cultivate the way you do, and maybe some of the overview of your guys' production process, because every mushroom farm is different. It's highly dependent on the species, the substrate, all the different needs that go with that. But tell us a little bit about that production process for you guys cultivating the gourmet edibles and medicinals that you work with.
So We grow lion's mane, shiitake, three different types of oyster, from blue cluster, pink and yellow, peel peony, shimeji, some shimeji, maitake. We do like some polypores seasonally, so reishi. Right now we're doing an outdoor grow of tremedes, so turkey tail. And those are mostly for medicinal lines. Wood ear, we usually do in the summertime. So a lot. But the main three are shiitake, oyster, and lion's mane. Oh, and then also king oyster. A lot of different varieties.
Are these all wood decomposers? As you're listing them, I'm trying to think of that is. But are these all wood decomposers?
We produce on a wood-based substrate, yeah. So nothing that we're growing is a compost-based substrate.
Right, which when you go to like a big white button mushroom farm, Agaricus bisporus farm, of course, they're dealing with compost, and there's kind of a whole process for them to make that complex substrate. For you guys, because I'm always curious about like the scale and the size, because a lot of people listening have, you know, grown mushrooms at home, they've gotten a block, maybe a Far West fungi block, fruited oyster mushrooms in their kitchen. But in terms of supplying the level of operation that you guys have, is it like some kind of recycled waste stream that you're able to use? Or how do you put together the substrate to supply your needs for all these different species?
So it's a wood-based substrate. It's mostly alder, oak, and maple. Mostly alder. It comes from a cabinetry maker.
Oh,
so
wow.
So one of the large cabinetry makers in California is not too far from us, and that's where the wood comes from. So it's a waste product. They want to get rid of it. They kick out 4 semi-loads a week of sawdust, and we take 1 a week.
So there is scalability there. There's plenty of wood substrate.
Yes, it's relatively cheap compared to like if you were buying like pellets. Pellets are very expensive, and then we'll age the wood for 3 months before we use it. That is like a fermentation process. So we want it to hydrate and kind of change the structure of the wood. And so from there, we'll age it. It hydrates it. The microbial activity, somewhere in the middle of the 3 months will kind of go up, and then we'll reduce the spore load. So we have a cleaner product. And then we're going to add different agricultural waste. So rice bran's a big one because we get a lot from Sacramento. And, a couple others like soy waste, and even some cotton waste. So you're trying to grow mushrooms on relatively cheap and, things that other things won't want to eat.
That's right. And I love hearing that it is kind of these waste streams, because I think that's such a huge part of what gets people excited about mushrooms as a food product. Is we're in this day and age where we have to be so conscious of sustainability. You know, like I said, we're broadcasting here in Sonoma County. This is a giant agricultural center. And I've been trying to think about, man, can we have these decentralized regional mushroom farms, because there's so much ag waste. So it's really inspiring to hear that in practice. And I'm curious, how much then do you have to tweak things or dial things for the different species? So we got the big recipe, but just to give people an idea with like shumeji or nameko, some things that I've never grown, you know, how much do you have to change things around versus like an oyster or a shiitake that I think of as a little more robust?
You do. I mean, it's different supplementation rate. Shiitake is probably the simplest recipe. And then I would say like lion's mane, oyster, and are probably a little bit higher supplementation. Maitake is probably the most complex recipe. So it just depends. Like I would never go above like 35% supplementation though. A lot of people like the master's mix, which is like 50-50, is, I think, just way too much.
What are the pitfalls of having too much supplementation? What gives you that guiding principle?
So you have waste. So you're like the fungi, it doesn't really need that much supplementation for increasing your yield. So you're just wasting money on supplementation. Other things is like contamination. So if it like doesn't break down all that nutrient-rich material, then you'll have a higher chance of like contamination when you do fruit the mushroom. Do you have like all this excess stuff on the blocks, you know? And if you're doing multiple flushes, that's when that problem will occur. Probably first flush would be fine. So yeah, and I would say the big one is really just, you know, bottom line, what it costs to make that block. If you're just putting a bunch of stuff in there and it's not using it, well, you know, and it didn't increase your yield, so why are we doing it? The other thing is, you know, heat is a factor that a lot of people don't think about. So like the more energy rich material, the hotter the substrate gets, and then the more energy to cool. So that's another thing. One thing we do is we top spawn, which would mean instead of shaking the bag, we're actually, you know, the mushroom is growing top down. And with that growth of going top down, it's a slower process. So it actually, instead of getting these crazy heat spikes when you like do a shake, the heat is more evenly distributed through the growth process. It's slower, but in Moss Landing, we have a passive system. So we're not using AC in all our rooms. Right. And so we don't want to see that. We want to see a more stable heat load in the rooms.
That's fascinating. I've not thought about that when it comes to substrate, about heat load, about climate control. And as you say that, I've been to the Moss Landing, some of the warehouses there, and they're obviously hooked up with kind of, you know, moisturizing sprayers in the top. But yeah, there's no AC units cranking there.
And our other farm in San Martin has AC on every building. It's crazy. We use way more electricity and grow less mushrooms at that site than Moss Landing.
Well, tell us a little bit about a little bit more about that location, because I always think of like the Moss Landing flagship. Like I said, that's where we would go for the community mushroom events. What's going on at the other facility in St. Martin? Is it like different species, or what's the project over there?
So we grow mostly oyster, and we're starting to do more maitake production there. But the main thing is we have our spawn lab there. So that's where we do all our cryo storage and our spawn production. And so we have its own separate site. And I have three guys that run my spawn to maintain cultures and, you know, decide on which lines are doing well. And then we also distribute spawn for some other smaller farms.
That invaluable genetic library that is... Yes. That is the I was almost going to call it bloodlines, the spore lines that make these beautiful mushrooms. Talk a little bit about that, about selecting for commercial strains. I know there are certain strains that go around the industry as like, this is the best, biggest fruiting version of, you know, whatever it is. I think recently we saw kind of this eruption of a certain black pearl strain. Talk about that a little bit. I mean, you guys make some of your own strains? Do you do specific breeding? How do you fight against senescence, or that, maybe I'm saying the wrong word, but that idea that you can't expand out forever?
Right. So we don't do breeding, but you know, we do have, you know, we'll try different commercial strains. We work with different companies. And then our main thing is we do all sawdust spawn, which is not very popular in North American industry. It's mostly grain is a right. common spawn. But in Asia, it's pretty much all sawdust spawn. So they don't really use grain spawn outside of, the Western world in that way, I guess. So it mostly grain spawn is for agaricus production, and then exotic growers kind of adopted it just because that was like the common substrate that was used. But in general, we're growing wood-based mushrooms, so we find the sawdust spawn is cheaper and then also more stable. And then for strain storage, we use liquid nitrogen, and we also have a deep freezer. So we have two different storage methods. The nice thing about liquid nitrogen is it's if the power goes out, it doesn't shut off. And then the deep freezer is, you know, cheaper to maintain.
And can you speak to, do you guys have to test at each stage? Because I've heard that expanding out onto different substrates, there can be slight mutations that happen or things that are unexpected that happen. So do you guys have to kind of QC as you take something out of the cryo from like a petri dish or whatever the container is and start expanding it out into more and more substrates till your eventual kind of fruiting block? Is there kind of QC that has to happen in between there?
Definitely. So we'll go from mother to like, we call it like master plates. So we'll make multiple plates from the mother. And then those are the plates we're going to be using maybe through that year. We'll do those expansions. From there, we'll do, you know, we'll make other plates. And then from those plates, we'll go straight to the substrate of some kind. So it might go to on strain for like the master bags. And then from there, it might go on to sawdust. But always the main production spawn will always be a sawdust material. And what we've found is, you know, you could go from grain to grain and everything would look fine. But right when you go from grain to sawdust or sawdust to sawdust or anytime it hits the sawdust, that's when you'll see your mutation. So it's kind of also a catch because, you know, grain is just a bunch of junk food, right? and the wood is more complex. And so if you're going to see some weird mutation, it could be on grain, but most likely if that fungi is weak or something, that grain is kind of sustaining it regardless. And so the sawdust, when it grows on that substrate, it actually is going to have to produce different enzymes and do all this stuff, which is what's kind of true to your own growing medium. And that's what really helps us catch a lot of problems that I think a lot of people don't catch.
That's fascinating because it switches to that sawdust or that wood. Suddenly you're asking the mushroom to flex its facultative capacities to decompose and create enzymes. And if it's a weak strain, like you're saying, that shows up. Super interesting. And there's your experience in other markets, looking at other cultures, giving you guys a unique and useful result.
Yeah, I mean, liquid is very, like in Japan, I think liquid is really only used for enoki. And pretty much all other varieties are still very true to the sawdust. I know in this day and age with a lot of Q-benzi production, everyone's liquid, it's super, you know, this is what we do and all this. But outside of the U.S., it's not messing with much. They're pretty traditional to most mushroom species.
And that would make sense to me. And I would be really curious about the nutritional profiles of your final mushroom product on something grown in a liquid culture versus wood. Have you guys looked at nutritional profiles at all? And it's just something that it's been a curiosity for me. I had a couple folks on the podcast who talked about doing some initial studies on, you know, different supplementation and what that yielded in terms of like vitamin and mineral content in the mushroom fruit body. Is that something you guys have looked at all?
So in the testing space, we're moving a little bit more into it because we're doing some extraction.
Yeah.
And mostly we're looking for very specific compounds. But as I talk to a lot of people, it's just not there yet. Like everything isn't there yet. You know, when we look at a lot of these supplements and different products, really what they're testing for is beta-glucan.
Right.
Which doesn't tell us much. I mean, you can test for beta-glucan, but it doesn't, you know, we can say, yeah, we got a lot of beta-glucan. But if you're talking about like lion's mane or you're looking for hericinase or something like that, we can say, yeah, it's there, but we can't tell you the concentration of it. And so I think as this space changes, testing is going to be so important because my belief, which a lot of people, you know, don't talk that much about, is it's the substrate, what the fungi is going to be eating is very important. Regardless of the strain, strain is also important. You know, nature and nurture is both important.
Yeah.
But, you know, we might be developing new strains and new substrate profiles to grow or increase certain desired compounds. And I think that's what we need to, you know, look at. And I think the testing is going to lead us to what we need to be doing. That's my belief. You know, is that we're developing strains and we're developing substrates that are going to increase certain beneficial compounds in these fungi.
I 100% agree with what you're saying. And it's something that when when it was first presented to me, it seems so basic. But like you're saying, there's limitations in how we can test for some of these compounds, right? I mean, is it just we don't have great, controls so that when we do run some kind of chromatograph or something, we don't know exactly what we're looking for? Is it just not having lab testing or it's too expensive? Or what's that choke point right now?
You know, I'm not an expert on that area. My background is biology. But it sounds like, the testing, the weight of these compounds, whatever it is hard to get right now. And it's not there. You know, as we know, the cannabis front right now is not doing so well. So a lot of those labs that were testing cannabis products are now jumping into mushrooms in a big way. And so I'm hoping, you know, in the next, 5 years, we'll start having like, you know, ability to say, hey, I grew these mushrooms. I made this batch. I extracted them out. And then I can give you a QR code with my test results when you buy that product. That would be amazing.
And I think for every consumer, anyone who you know, sees mushrooms for their nutritional value, that's like the dream, right? Is that you'll have that capacity. And it's funny because a lot of mushroom testing or testing of mushroom fruit bodies really starts in, like you said, the psilocybin space. People were interested in what are these, you know, tryptamine compounds? What are they doing? How much is in there? But I'm seeing some of those groups now branch out and they're starting to realize the same thing Kyle's realizing is, wait, are we doing this to the mushrooms that we eat or take medicinally? I mean, don't we want to know what's in these too? So I think it'll be really interesting to see as, yeah, the cannabis group moves into mushrooms, as then things branch out from folks interested in psilocybin into gourmet and medicinal. You know, we're just at the beginning of this wave of our understanding of mushrooms.
Yeah, and there's certain compounds that we don't even talk about, like ergothionine, which is like this anti-aging compound that there's a lot of awesome research coming out. And it's just a compound not even really on anyone's knowledge, you know, we're not even talking about it. But I think that's the other thing, is there could be a bunch of stuff that we don't even know.
That's right. There's compounds in there that we aren't testing for because we don't even know they're in there.
Don't even know.
Well, and more of what I've been learning too is that, you know, these compounds, a lot of the beneficial medicinal compounds we want, I mean, they're present in every mushroom. As much as we know that lion's mane is a superstar, like there are certain medicinal mushroom superstars, like there are medicinal capacities in all of these mushrooms you guys are growing.
Right. And then ergothionine is really high in oysters.
Mm.
And like oysters is not even one of those that are acknowledged as a very medicinal mushroom, you know, in some ways. So it could be a very popular supplement now, but it's not on anyone's radar. It's lion's mane, reishi, turkey tail, chaga. I mean, maitake and shiitake aren't really that talked about. And I think maitake is one of those really amazing mushrooms.
Shiitake as well. And I'm interested to see how that space changes as people, yeah, maybe it's as testing expands. I love that piece of how people play with substrate. I think that's going to be such an interesting thing to see substrate technology evolve. And like, what are the tiny little artful additions of some food waste or something that yields a whole different nutrient profile?
I think that's, yeah, because we know that, you know, we are what we eat. So, you know, maybe there's compounds in the wood that we can't access, but the fungi can bioaccumulate, which would be also more beneficial to us. Just certain things that are there that these fungi can do that we, you know, would make a more nutritious mushroom in the end.
Yeah. And do you see, because you know so many more mushroom farmers than I ever will, do you see people in the industry getting interested in this as well? Do you see that a direction things might be moving, maybe for the kind of folks that are focused more on gourmet and medicinal?
I think there's some people who care, yeah, in a big way. I think the problem is there's just, they don't have any direction. There's a lot of excitement, but you know, the majority of people that are growing most of these mushrooms that we're consuming are just trying to grow mushrooms. You know, they're just one every day. Mushroom farming is a very labor intensive, hard, you know, business. And I think that on the, you know, medicinal front, you have a lot of, you know, substrate companies, mycelated grain products, and then you have extractors that are bringing a lot of fruiting bodies from Asia. So it hasn't quite sussed out for the domestic mushroom farmer to really move into that space. And, you know, we're trying, but, you know, it's hard. You know, it's more expensive to grow mushrooms in the U.S.
Exactly. I see it as this great differentiator for U.S. producers, but you're also competing against other markets that have massive volume, costs of scale. I mean, talk about that a little. Do you see the niche growing for domestic production? Like I said, probably five times now, you guys are in the grocery stores everywhere. We see Far West Fungi. But what is that like to carve out a niche for domestic production of these gourmet medicinal mushrooms?
You know, it is about marketing and understanding your consumer and working with your consumer and having those relationships. I mean, we've been doing farmers markets since the start of this company. And so I think that's part of it, is educating your consumer, talking about like our mushrooms are grown on the coast of Monterey and like you're using these, you know, whole products to grow our mushrooms and we're bringing them to you and you're helping my family and my children and all the people to grow. And understanding it, I think that's part of it. We also, you know, as we talked about collaborating, we want to get to a certain size in this industry so we can invest in research and development and partner with colleges so we can develop our own understanding of these fungi. You know, we don't have to just piggyback off of these amazing cultures that have been, you know, using them for millennia, you know? So it's, I think that's part of it too, is that like we have to understand about developing our own domestic production. We deal with a lot of competition from overseas. One of the biggest things that we've been working on is a California grown label, because a lot of people don't realize that a lot of the substrate is getting imported from Asia. And then they bring the blocks here and then they fruit them and then they call it product of the USA. And so a lot of people think, hey, I'm helping this local farm, but actually it's being shipped on a container at 0 degrees, dropped here, defrosted and fruited. And then they're like, product of the USA. So our new bill that actually has passed the first round in Sacramento, it's great. We're really excited. My partner, Erin, has been working super hard on it, and she's doing an amazing job. And what it's requiring to be California grown would be inoculated, incubated, and fruited in California to be considered a product of California.
I love that, because as much as, hey, there's these different markets, a lot of people in the industry, you have to put together different pieces of your production chain through certain outsourced methods just to make it economical as you start and grow. So I don't want to put any shame to anybody who uses kind of outsourced methods like that. But I think one of the biggest things that appeals to a lot of us about mushrooms, I mean, as an organism, but as a food supply and as a medicine, is this idea that it's somehow building resiliency. It's like taking waste streams and reusing it. And part and parcel with that is the idea that economically, its benefit is helping the community which it's coming from, right? Like it's actually keeping something in a localized kind of, like I said, resilient economic framework. And so the idea that we would be really pushing to have some kind of at least recognition for people that are choosing to do it that way. Like, look, we every step of the way have, you know, ostensibly paid people in California, gotten supplies in California to make this product that's enjoyed by people in this local area. That is a concept that we should be supporting if we want local resiliency, because just the past few years, we've seen how these giant global supply chains aren't the most resilient. And actually, the economic benefit gets diffused over a huge region with tons of people. So, yes, I love this idea. Great job, Erin and Kyle.
Yeah, I mean, it's what we saw, you know, during the pandemic was a huge increase in sales because of the supply chain issues.
Yeah.
So, you know, it is also important for food security, you know, is to understand this. And as you know, Darren, when you've been here, grow mushrooms. The substrate takes a lot of space and time, and that is very important. When you outsource that whole process, you pretty much get rid of a whole mushroom farm. It's just rooms to be humidified. There's not much going on at that point. There's no knowledge anymore. So if you lose that knowledge, we don't even know how to grow mushrooms if we just outsource that whole process.
I find parallels in other farming with people getting obsessed about soil, which I'm sure all of you guys are as well. But that idea, like imagine a farmer bringing in soil from somewhere else. Like, I don't know how any of the soil works. I don't want to know. It's like, no, that's part of doing it. That's being the farmer.
Yeah. Yeah. If you just like trucked in giant tomato plants that have tomatoes on it and then be like, oh yeah, like I don't know how it works, but I just pick them and then it's all good. You know, it would be, you know, that you pretty much now don't know anything. You're just like, I just bring these in, I make sure the temperature's right, the humidity's right, and they grow and I pick them and then market. But I mean, I think we don't want to, you know, say that that is wrong or like to stop that process. We just want some way of the consumer being aware and being able to, you know, distinguish between ours and another product. And right now they can't. And so that's what we're saying is like, at least have consumers be aware of it. And we don't want to, you know, punish anyone, but we want to be able to somehow tell people, you know, if you want to, you know, also a green idea of like carbon footprint. I mean, bringing this stuff in on a ship going across the ocean, you're not getting a very green product. It's actually, you know, much more fossil fuel intensive process growing a block in Asia and then transporting it here. And I think that people should have that knowledge as well, knowing like, hey, am I buying a local product that is benefiting the environment in some ways a little bit more?
Well, like I said, absolutely, because that's what we want to think about for those of us who love mushrooms. We don't want to think, oh, this is actually ecologically damaging. You know, this mushroom as a product took less water and less da-da-da. Oh, but we had to put it on a giant container ship. So yeah, let's keep the ecological ethos of why we like or why we see so much hope in mushrooms as a food product moving forward. And with what you were saying there, you know, I really appreciate that you're saying like, hey, for anybody who's doing an operation where they have to put these parts together, we don't want to discourage that. But also by what you're doing, you're giving them a path to grow more of in your direction, right? By giving an incentive framework and something you can say, look, now there is a space for you to engage in this full production process or at least work your way there. And we've made it more profitable. We've got better marketing to build consumers' knowledge and give you more of a market.
Right. And then that's the other thing where I also have a whole side of the business now that is just helping farms automate their production, understanding the technology that's out there, consulting them if they want to get to the next level in a lot of ways. Is also, we are willing to do that. We're not this, you know, isolated company. We're very out there to say, hey, we want our industry in the U.S. to grow, be competitive, to you know, to get to a certain size where we're not so easily pushed around, I guess, in some ways. So we, you know, so we can actually, you know, do that research and development we're hoping to do. And I'm much rather compete with a farm in the United States than overseas, you know. And so I'm happy to make competitors in that way, because I know that, you know, anything that's somebody that I would like to compete. It's really difficult when you have, you know, certain countries that are, you know, government helps in a lot of ways to increase their production. And there's definitely some dumping that happens.
Yeah, absolutely. And I love that idea about building capacity. It's building these networks with other farmers to build out our domestic infrastructure. And I'm going to love when these conversations start infiltrating with kind of mainstream, I don't even want to say mainstream, other forms of agriculture, because it goes so naturally. If you're a farmer, I'm going to give a plug again, you're listening on 103.3 KPCA in Petaluma, you're listening to the Mushroom Hour. We're talking with Kyle Garoni of Far West Fungi all about ag and growing mushrooms. And I think it's such a natural marriage with a facility that, let's say, has, you know, hundreds of chickens or hundreds of cows. There's waste streams from that. And if they had the knowledge and there is this space there, a market, an addressable market they see and a movement behind this, oh yeah, we'll open up kind of a mushroom part, or we'll partner with another farm and make sure we have a mushroom farm. And then suddenly you get a space for, I think, this industry to survive if, you know, other people, or what do I want to say? If other ag is conscious of it, you suddenly have the means of production much more accessible. I think, you know, the arrangement you guys have is fantastic, but I know other mushroom farms can struggle to kind of set up those arrangements. So as this disseminates more into other agricultural disciplines, it'll be really interesting to see them kind of help bring mushroom or help make mushroom farming easier and a part of their process.
Definitely. I mean, if you go to China, you know, one of the biggest drivers that the country communist government invested in was building mushroom institutes in every like province.
Wow.
You know that's one of their ways of bringing people out of poverty is growing mushrooms. You know, and that's, you know, that's one of the most dominant mushroom growing countries is China, and that has to have a direct relationship to that, you know. And we don't do any of that, you know? You go to Japan and you can get a very low interest loan to grow mushrooms because they put their energy into that. You know, they put their dollars into that too. But the government gives, you know, very beneficial loans to people that are growing mushrooms. And that's why they can also scale and have very cheap mushrooms, which is also important to have everyone eat mushrooms so we can actually make a mushroom. It's not the luxury product. The lion's mane for everyone in that way. And that's all about scalability and how, you know, the government puts a priority to the farmer.
Absolutely. And we do have such robust government infrastructure for ag. And maybe this is part of the role of the greater MICO community in making this cool, making it a popular thing, is maybe it raises that visibility even more. You've had all these farmers doing it for decades. They're trying to create this domestic mushroom production. You know, hopefully the echo chamber of people excited about mushrooms, posting videos, bopping the top of a bolete, maybe that can disseminate and raise this to a point where we have to grapple with this and somehow lead to some kind of government action. And you guys are on the front lines putting bills forward that create markets in California. Super exciting.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, that's just the next step kind of in our mind, is just like, how can we do more? How can we give this industry the best chance of, you know, moving in the right direction? You know, everyone's eating mushrooms now. I want to make sure those mushrooms are grown in the US 100%. You know, that's a big passion of mine. And also just awareness and knowledge. I mean, I went to an ag college and I studied plant biology because that was the only bachelor's degree where I could take a bunch of ecology. I went to UC Davis, but that, you know, it was a big ag school. So mushroom farming was not part of it. That wasn't part of the agenda.
That's what I'm saying. We've got a huge ag infrastructure of people interested in it, university structure, government structure, like local farm bureaus. We need to make sure mushrooms are part of that conversation because it fits with everything else. We can use your waste streams. We have waste streams that can be used for other things for you. I mean,
so much waste. And the waste that's like, you know, dangerous waste that maybe we could use fungi to do. Maybe it would be not even to grow mushrooms. Maybe it's just to like stabilize waste or produce byproducts from that waste that are myceliated in some way. You know, I think it's a very big part of the equation, you know.
And as you're saying that, I see economies growing around that, right? You have farms feeding mushroom farms, then feeding back, but they could do research on creating like different inoculum stacks or different stacks of microorganisms, including certain fungi, to better fertilize fields or better support crops with certain mycorrhizal associations. Or as people develop more and more ideas of how certain blends can mix with like cyanobacteria and different things in the soil, you know, this may be a farmer may be able to fund mushroom projects that then do research that eventually give them an inoculum that can like remove PFAS from their fields or something. Like, there could be such a cool economy that builds around this. And in a country that needs, you know, economy and needs more areas to kind of grow and then heal our planet at the same time, this is easy.
I mean, our farm's surrounded by strawberry fields, and you know, they are, it's one of the most sprayed crops, and mainly what they're trying to get rid of is other fungi that grow on it. You know, I mean, it's the fungus that they're worried about. So is there a way we could put a beneficial fungi on there that wouldn't affect the strawberries to outcompete, you know, there's so much to go there.
Those worlds will collide. And I love to hear that you're kind of on the front lines, and that's not something I'm imagining, but you see it actually being in the industry. Well, I do want to make sure we talk about the event coming up here in the first weekend of May. It's going to be huge. It's going to be massive. Give us all the details about the Santa Cruz Mountain Mushroom Festival. Tell us everything we need to know about it.
It is everything that we have done over the last 40 years. We're trying to put in one festival, if that makes sense. So it's going to be, we have how many different stages? We have like six different stages. So we have the lion's mane stage, the shiitake stage. We have the cooking demo stage. We have a music stage. We have a Huckleberry Hall, which is like kind of a quieter thing, so you can do more PowerPoint stuff. And then we have the Redwood stage, which is in the forest. So deep into the forest, kind of this cool forested stage, which is awesome. We're going to have cooking demos. We're going to have live music. We're going to have talks from, you know, cultivation to truffle growing to you know, psychedelic stuff, everything in between. This last summer, I went on kind of a mushroom festival tour just to kind of see, and we kind of felt like everyone had their own benefit, but we kind of wanted to mix it up and talk about what has existed and what was, you know, around in San Francisco Bay Area, the food scene, the mushroom scene that's always been there, And kind of just kind of showcase that in a big way, which is really important to us. We have mycotexture stuff, bioremediation. And so, you know, we want to showcase all those aspects. I think we have over 60 vendors coming, different people, you know, with their mushroom wares, you know, education. So it's going to be, our hope is it's going to be, you know, just something that everyone's going to enjoy and have a great time and eat a lot of mushrooms and dance and be inspired by these fungi in a lot of ways. That's my hope. Cause every day I wake up and I'm like, how can I, you know, grow a different mushroom? How can I, you know, do a different thing with fungi in my life? So I think that's my hope, is just trying to inspiring people, which is important.
It's massive. And what we've talked about with trends that we're seeing and what we hope mushrooms grow into, I mean, the culture and building culture around it is a huge part of that. And
right.
I can't name off everyone that'll be there because it's way too many. It's like every mycological cool person who's doing something interesting with mushrooms, I feel like, is going to be there. The amount of people that have asked me if I'm going, I'm like, wait, you're going? You're across the country. And they're like, oh yeah, I'm flying over for that. So it's really going to be like a vortex of like mycological culture. And then I had another friend of mine who's not as into mushrooms. He just recognized the venue. He was like, oh, I love it down there. He's like, have you ever been there? That venue is crazy. Tell us a little bit about the venue.
So Roaring Camp has old steam trains, which is like what their main thing's about. And they take these old, cool steam trains into the Redwood Forest. So yeah. It's basically the whole event is surrounded by the Redwood Forest. And so you're going to be able to take train rides into the forest, and we'll have some forays, which, you know, there's not that many mushrooms that grow in the forest, but there's definitely a bunch of mushrooms that will be there. There's also other tree species as well, but it's mostly redwood. And so, yeah, we're going to have nature walks, which is really awesome. And then also there's a train that if you wanted to start in Santa Cruz by the boardwalk, you can take a train all the way into the event, which is pretty cool. It's about a 45-minute train.
That is the shroom train. And that makes total sense, because my buddy who knew about Roaring Camp is a huge steam head. So that all makes sense now. This event, for anyone who wants to find more information, where can they go to learn about the event? I mean, it's coming up here in just a couple weeks.
Santa Cruz Mountain Mushroom Festival .com. Or if you type in Santa Cruz Mushroom Festival, it will pop up on Google like instantly. So if you just type that in, you'll find it. Yeah.
100% Santa Cruz Mushroom Festival. And I know in kind of getting prepared for it, I'd shared some emails with Aaron. You just said Aaron was drafting legislation. It feels like Aaron is like this goddess with 1,000 arms doing so much stuff. Tell us about what that's been like to be in partnership and like have these projects and have that collaboration. Just tell us about that.
So yeah, me and Aaron have kids together. We have these festivals together. We have bills together. We work really well together. Aaron's my like amazing supporter and also my rock in so many ways. And she is telling me how glad she will be when she's excited about the festival, but also excited when that's over right now, because it's a heavy lift. It's a really heavy lift, but it's going to be so amazing. And I'm excited just to see all my friends around the world. Farmers that I've talked to forever that I've never met in person, you know, just all these different people, which part of it is also just, you know, who these people are really important. They're, you know, some of the best information you can get out. And that's part of it, is that, you know, we want to make sure we have good information, experts that are really kind of sharing this knowledge, really important.
Absolutely. Good information is everything. And as much as social media and the internet is amazing for disseminating, getting people, I was just talking with Dr. Mandrake and Virginia Hayes about like psilocybin related stuff, but it's that idea that like, yeah, there's more information out there and it's easy to get people pulled in and interested, but then you really need to find those areas where the information is good and validated by experience. And yeah, you're going to have all of those people there.
And that's what we want, to make sure that people are getting the right information and kind of clear a little bit of that noise. There's a lot out there, as we know. With every boom, you get a lot of different stuff. So we just hope that, you know, people come. Kids under 12 are free. So it's a very kid-focused event as well. We have a local Girl Scout chapter doing a whole kid zone. So we have a fungal kid zone. We have a lot of DIY stuff. I just cut 4 pallets of logs on my own property. So we're going to have a whole inoculation, log inoculation. We're doing a bunch of straw substrate this week. So we'll have straw to be inoculated. And all these DIY things are free. If you want to take a big log home, you can take it. If you want to just do the inoculation and leave it there, we'll have that available. We'll have some port injection bags if you want to see how to do a liquid inoculum. So there's going to be a lot of awesome DIY stuff that people are paper making, mushroom dyeing. There's going to be a whole koji thing. There's a whole fermentation stuff. So just not specifically a fungi that produce mushrooms, but all different fungi aspects, you know, a lot of beer drinking, also fungal related. So, you know,
that's right. It fits.
And so, so I think I'm going to be, hopefully I don't eat too much, but you know, eating a lot of mushrooms and, we have one person to talk about is, we do have Field and Forest and they're the ones running the log cultivation area. So that's one of they've been doing log cultivation forever.
I love that. And I love that you guys are going to bring people in who like didn't come on this new wave like I did. Like you guys are connected with people that have been doing this work for a long time. So it's going to be this interesting blend, I have a feeling, of people that have been doing things with mushrooms and intimately connected with these organisms forever. And then all the people like me who just got interested in the last 10 years. I mean, what a cool collaboration that's going to be.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing. Like the people from Field Force, my parents have known them since the early 80s. They just met them. We were in Vegas at the North American Mushroom event, and it was the first time they met them ever, and they've known them forever. It's crazy.
That's wild.
You know? And they've had a mushroom business since, you know, they do a whole bunch of, you know, mostly outdoor mushroom production. So we're bringing in companies and friends, competitors, everything. We don't care. We want people to be there to share their message, talk about mushrooms. That's the point of this event. It's not specifically a Pharos fungi event. This is a mushroom event for everyone.
That example of your parents knowing Field and Forest forever and just meeting them is why these events are so important. Is you can work with people or talk with people online or like I have been on Instagram or TikTok or whatever. But then it's like, I've never met this person. I've never been around them.
You
I've never
like
been.
You know them, you know, or you talk to them every day on the phone or something. You're weird. And then you like right. Never meet them. Like, oh, well, you're across the country. I'm too busy. I grow mushrooms. I got no time.
But it's like, I want to feel the magnetic fields of these other people and like the energetic exchange as we get excited and talking in person. And I always steal this term from Antonio Cosme, who came on the show, called collective effervescence. This idea that you all come together and like work on something, like we're all doing this log inoculation together. We're all riding the train together. There's like this unique energy that happens where now you're kind of bonded in a new way.
Definitely. Yeah. I love hanging out with mushroom people just because they get me.
That's right. Well, as we wind down, I just want to remind listeners on KPCA, you're listening to the Mushroom Hour. If you want to find more information, you can go to welcometomushroomhour.com for all of our podcasts and stay tuned on KPCA for Fridays at 9 a.m. to tune into the show. And if you want to find more information about the Santa Cruz Mountain Mushroom Festival, go to santacruzmountainmushroomfestival.com or search Santa Cruz Mushroom Festival and you'll find it. And if you want to find out more information about Far West, go to your grocery store, go to farwestfungi.com, search Far West Fungi. They've got tons of information and tons for you to get into if you're interested in mushrooms. Kyle, thank you so much for joining us on the Mushroom Hour. It's been an awesome conversation.
Thank you for having me. Yeah, we'll see you at the festival.